Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're looking forward to today's show. Towards the back end, we are going to be talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela, the artistic director of the Latino Theater Company and the Los Angeles Theater Center, and Bianca Bagatorian, playwright and president of the Armenian Dramatic Arts Alliance, about the possibilities and responsibilities of world artists in shaping a new future in a post-9/11 world. Before that, we'll be listening to some excerpts from an interview that Carl Dix did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And that's going to be the whole interview is called The New Situation, The War on Terrorism. And this is actually called War on Terrorism, this excerpt. But before that, I'm very pleased to be talking about my first segment of the show. And my first segment of the show, you know, 40 years ago, this is a week of anniversaries, right? Well, this anniversary is particularly important, and I think it's one that not enough people are really aware of or paying attention to, and they need to. And it's the 40th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion. The Attica Rebellion was a rebellion in the Attica State Prison in New York, and it was one of the most significant rebellions in U.S. history, if not the most significant prison rebellion in U.S. history. And listen, just to give you a sense of it, I want to let you hear a few words before we jump into this. So check this out. This is the Attica Manifesto.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard of the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to the situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who enslave and exploit the people of America.
That was L.D. Barkley, a 21-year-old prisoner in Attica State Prison back in 1971, September 9th, 1971. And L.D. Barkley was also one of the leaders of that rebellion, and he was someone who was murdered in cold blood by the state troopers sent out by Nelson Rockefeller, who was then governor of New York, to execute and to put down the rebellion by the most vicious means possible, to send a message to the prisoners and to people all over the country and people all over the world about the nature of this society and what they will not tolerate, which is standing up against them. Joining us to talk about the Attica Rebellion today is Carl Dix, who's a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and James Benjamin, who was a participant in the Attica Rebellion. He's one of the Attica brothers, and he's one of the moral compasses. He was one of the moral compasses at the Attica protest. All right, so welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us on, Michael.
Sure. And James, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for inviting me to your show.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You know, one of the things that struck me as I was preparing for the thing and thinking about why I wanted to do a segment on this, an important segment on this rebellion, was that 40 years down the line, a lot of people really aren't that familiar with Attica. It's become, to those that do know it, it's sometimes just a name that gets, you know, that has had some, you know, influence in the society at large. But it's a name, and a lot of the younger people that are out there today who are actually thinking about changing the world weren't even alive when the Attica Rebellion happened, and we know that there's been a very, very strong effort to kind of erase it out of history, or at the very best, to completely distort that history. So, James, why don't you tell people what the rebellion was, and then we can talk a little bit more about why it's important to commemorate this today.
Well, the rebellion was everything that L.D. Barkley, whose recording you just played, it was everything he said, and a bit more. The more extends to today. We need to address the same issues that we tried to address then. We need to address them now because they have gotten a little worse. The establishment has gotten a little more, has gotten a lot more sophisticated and ingenious, and they're doing the same thing, and they're doing it at a different level, and it's still hurting us.
Well, Carl, how about you? Can you talk a little bit about what, give people a sense of what the rebellion was, even in terms of the you know, just give them the stats about who did what, when, and how.
Well, look, I was in Fort Leavenworth Military Penitentiary in the hole when Attica happened. And, I mean, it really electrified a generation of people, you know, because here you have these hundreds of prisoners in Attica, people who are supposed to be the worst of the worst, the dregs of society and all that, who rose up against the brutal conditions being put down on them. And then when they controlled the prison, some things that used to go on didn't, because prison was a place where there were and still are today sharp divisions based upon race among the prisoners. There would often be instances of prisoners attacking and killing other prisoners over petty stuff. But when the prisoners controlled Attica, that wasn't what went down. There was unity between prisoners of different races and nationalities. They shared what food they had, not only amongst themselves, but amongst the amongst the guards that had been taken hostage, you know, as part of their leverage to force the state to negotiate around their demands. So what you were seeing was people rising up and fighting the power and transforming themselves and others. And that's what you need for revolution. And revolution is what's needed, because like James said, this question of conditions in prison has intensified. There are far more people in prison. The conditions are worse. And you could say the same for conditions throughout the society and around the world. And revolution is what's needed to address that. Now, James could tell you from a different angle than me about what some of this was like, because he was right there. And like you said, he played a role around what was the direction, the ethos, and the morality of the uprising in Attica.
Well, let me just make a point to clarify for people who might not know. The actual character of the rebellion, or actually what the rebellion looked like in a broad sense, and it was 1,200 prisoners at Attica in upstate New York seized control of half of the prison. They took 38 prison guards hostage, and for 4 days the Attica brothers controlled D Yard, issuing a call to people on the outside to witness the brutal nature of the system and support their stand. I mean, this was an incredibly important, and just like as you both are saying, it was something that just sort of, you know, took, I mean, really, really just reshaped the entire way that people were looking at a whole part of society and a whole, and the question of possibility as well. Now, James, how about it? What did it look like? What was the rebellion like? Tell people, speaking from somebody who was on the inside, what was the rebellion like? What did it look like? What did it feel like? And you, again, as you said, being one of the moral compasses in the whole thing, what was it like?
Well, from the very, very beginning, it was rather chaotic. It took a ad hoc formation of the moral compasses to put the rebellion, to keep the rebellion on a egalitarian course. The first things that actually happened after taking the guards hostages was the commissary was burglarized, broken into, and we took everything out of the commissary. It completely emptied it, and at that point, the selfish people were saying, "This was mine, this was mine," and the egalitarian people, the ad hoc group, said, "No, no, no, we will put this in the middle of D Yard, and we will share it during the time that we're actually out here in the yard. We will smoke the cigarettes together. We will eat. We will make sandwiches or whatever we get, and we will do that together." Before we stepped in, there were some people who had so much ice cream that it was really melting all over them. We stopped that immediately and put a revolutionary spirit in the yard, which took us throughout the time that we controlled the prison. And as you've said earlier, we shared food with the guards. We kept any element in the prison society that wanted to retaliate fatally against the guards. We stopped them from doing the things that they wanted to do. We kept the guards alive. There was an element that wanted to cut the guards' throats. We decided that we didn't let that happen. We put our lives on the line so that the guards' throats would not be cut. But then again, what we did was all for naught, because as soon as the troopers came in and murdered the guards, they desecrated the bodies by cutting their throats, and it was only a medical examiner that cleared us from homicide indictments, because the medical examiner said that throats were not cut by inmates, but they were cut after the guards had been killed, after they were dead. We felt then and still feel now that we were justified in being angry with the system, but we would not stoop. We decided we would not stoop to the depths of the depths to which the system stooped, and we would be as moral and ethical, as egalitarian and as utilitarian as we could possibly be. And I think the facts now, 40 years later, it looks like that. I don't know why we don't have a greater voice in the way government is run, because we were able to do things at Attica, like share scarce resources, minimize racism, interpersonal assault, things of that nature. We were able to accomplish those. We were able to affect those things. And there, it seems to be now that there are all kind of commissioners and elected officials who can't do it. So I don't know why we're not hired. Those of us who are moral compasses at Attica, I don't know why we're not hired to help the government to do things for the people. Perhaps the alternative may be revolution. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think actually one thing you can learn from Attica is that in a small scale, in a very small world right there inside Attica, it actually showed the point about in a small, and I don't want to take this too far, but it did actually say something about you got to seize power. You got to seize the whole thing and have it in the hands, not relying on the authorities to actually do something. But you actually have to set up a whole new regime, which is sort of what you guys did in D-Yard. Now, Carl, and let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and James Benjamin, an Attica brother and one of the moral compass points.
May I cut you off for just one second, please?
Yeah, sure.
That is my name. My given birth certificate name is James Benjamin. However, I have a parenthetical AKA, and it is The Doctor.
The Doctor.
I am really James the Dr. Benjamin.
All right, we'll keep that clear from now on. So James Dr. Benjamin, who was one of the moral compass points of the rebellion inside Attica. Now, Carl, tell me something. You know, one of the things that happened you look at what happened in Attica, and I was talking with somebody about this last night and thinking about it for a while, that a lot of what happened in Attica was very, 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 very much tied into what was going on in the world, and including both the Black Liberation Movement, the 60s, the whole spirit of the 60s, the rebellions around the world, the revolutions around the world, the Black Liberation Movement inside the U.S., and including the assault against that movement, most especially the murder of George Jackson, just a few weeks before the Attica Rebellion broke out. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, that was a very important influence on the times, and came into the prisons, and then it also reverberated out of the prisons, because you see someone like George Jackson, who went into prison for robbery but became a revolutionary in prison because of what was going on outside of the prison, and then wrote from in the prison books that brought revolution from in the prisons back out to the society and building on each other. And that was a very important influence of that time, and it's something that we're looking at a lot today, because you do have the horror of 2.5 million people warehoused in prisons across this society, and that they are there not because they are criminals, but that the system has criminalized whole generations of youth, treated them like they're criminals, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive their encounters with the cops to prove their innocence. So this is an important thing that we feel has to be dealt with. And the legacy of Attica, the vision of the prisoners rising up and transforming themselves through the course of fighting the power, is very, very important today. You see that in what the prisoners in California did and are planning to do again if the state does not pay attention to their very just and real demands. You also see that in prison resistance in Georgia earlier and other places. And you need to see that around resistance to mass incarceration, which is something that I'm putting a whole lot of effort into. In the middle of October, we're going to do a day of stopping, stop and frisk here in New York, a day of nonviolent direct action. And people need to pay attention to that. We are looking to spread that across the country because this is a front around which we need to fight the power, and we need to bring to bear that legacy of Attica, that vision of people from the bottom of society standing up, resisting, and transforming themselves, and make it for revolution, because that's what it's going to take to deal with all of this stuff that's coming down on people here and around the world.
All right, we're going to try and listen to the recording of the demands being presented, as well as a statement from one of the prison guards who is being held in the in D Yard. And I wanted to, I want to do this because I want to get into, again, this rebellion has been painted with a terrible brush over the years by the authorities, and especially what's going on at the time where, as James was talking about, the way that the lies that were spread about the nature of the rebellion and what was going on there. So I want people to hear this in the prisoner's own words, and then we'll come back and talk about it a little.
Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want the governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite other people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want.
And that was L.D. Barkley, prisoners, one of the leaders of the Attica Rebellion, and reading the demands of the Attica prisoners in one of the greatest prison rebellions in the history of the U.S. And again, that was L.D. Barkley, one of the prisoners who was murdered by the state troopers dispatched by Nelson Rockefeller to savagely put down the entire rebellion. They opened fire. They shot at people from the walls. They killed guards, inmates alike, and they tortured many, many inmates afterwards. And as you heard James talking about earlier, they even went around and desecrated the guards' bodies in an attempt to make it seem that the prisoners themselves had killed the guards, when in fact they had all been killed by the state troopers, again dispatched by Nelson Rockefeller, then the governor of New York State. Now, this next clip we're going to hear is it's a statement from one of the prison guards, and actually it's very important, this statement, in terms of actually dispelling the myth and the terrible demonization of the prisoners by the powers that be, claiming that the prisoners murdered the guards or responsible for murdering the guards, when, as I said, the investigation afterwards showed beyond a doubt that the prisoners could not have murdered the guards, that their throats were cut in the aftermath after they were already dead, and that they were killed by bullets, bullets that the prisoners had no access to guns, they had no access to bullets, and the logical conclusion is that the guards were killed by the state troopers. So this is a statement from one of the prison guards.
What is your name, please? Frank Draw. What is your job?
Correction officer.
Now, we want to know exactly what do you think of the way you're treated in here by these men.
We all have been treated 100%. Been fed well, gave us blankets, slept on mattresses while they slept on the ground. Medication was given to us while they didn't get any. They took care of us first. We've been taken care of at least 100%.
How do you think these men should be treated henceforth?
I think they should be treated 150%. I know they have grievances. I know because I work with them. They've got grievances. I know these grievances. We have to tell those people out there about them.
We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
All right, that was the prisoners inside the Attica Rebellion talking about their demands, and then there was a guard talking about the truth about how the guards were actually being treated by the prisoners. Now, James, you know, one of the things, what do you think, you know, you started to talk about the lies that came down around this, and it was very vicious. I mean, I think one of the most important ones was what you were talking about of the way the prisoner, it was depicted that the prisoners killed all the guards, and then after a long time, it was shown that the guards were, in fact, killed by bullets that were fired by the forces of authority there. And, you know, one of the things, though, that it really did sort of that was a long fought struggle, right? I mean, it was decades before everything finally got resolved. And it did result in, actually, in the beginning, it resulted in one of the largest indictments in U.S. legal history. And I mean, it was like 62 prisoners are indicted, given 42 indictments and 1,289 charges. I mean, it was a pretty heavy scene they were really going after, and they really pursued the Attica brothers in particular, and those that they thought of as the leadership of that in a very vicious way, did they not?
Yes. In fact, they're still, 40 years later, they're still pursuing me. But that's a personal thing, and I don't want to really get into that right now. But I would like to make a comment from earlier with respect to the prisoners who were there, with respect to all of us, to George Jackson particularly. I'd like to make two comments. The first comment is that, yes, George's demise out in California, the authorities murdering him because he said he had a large caliber weapon hidden in his afro. How that's possible, I don't know, but they murdered him anyway, and that was their excuse or reason for doing so. And he was, in fact, in prison for robbery. This is a somewhat incidental, but I think it plays an important – I think it should be understood. He was, in fact, in prison for robbery. But in our school systems, the schools I went to, I never learned anything about – I wasn't taught anything about thinking critically. So I, too, was in prison for a larcenous offense. However, I thought my going to prison for a larcenous offense was my way of committing civil disobedience and changing property relations. As ridiculous as it may sound, that's what I thought. I mean, it's ridiculous now because I've had the privilege of graduating from a university, of finishing a 4-year undergraduate degree. But at that time, I didn't know. I didn't have the type of analytic skills that I've been blessed and fortunate to have trained in now. And I thought that I was doing something political. So I was in prison. I was in Attica, and I didn't think of myself as being criminal at all. I thought of myself as striking a blow against the unfairness and injustice that is so prevalent out here in our society. That's the first thing. And the second thing I'd like to say is that when George Jackson was murdered, we did something in Attica, but the police, that the prison guards or the administration or the authorities just seemed not to understand. They overlooked. We had a food, we did not eat to a man, 100% effective. We did not eat after George was murdered. And the prison authorities didn't realize how angry, how justifiably, how indignant we were. We just weren't angry. We were indignant. They didn't realize that. And we had to let them know a few weeks, a little while after, by just taking charge of the prison itself. Well, I just wanted to make those two somewhat irrelevant comments.
No, very important. And unfortunately, we're running up on our time, and I did want to have people listen to this one more clip. And then, Carl, I'll come back to you to talk about it, all right?
Okay.
What I see is this for the people in the street. I see, wake up. Stop hiding. Because the same thing is happening to me is happening to you. And deal. Petition, rallies, let the people, let the governor, let the president and the people that in a position to do something about this know how you feel about your sons and your daughters that's incarcerated. Other than that, wake up, because nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream.
All right, Carl, nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream. What do you think about that, and especially looking back on the Attica Rebellion today, its lessons, why it's so important?
Well, just looking back on it, the point that he makes about what's happening to me is happening to you, because prison is a concentration of the society that it's a part of. And that is very much true with this mass racially targeted incarceration today, because in fact you can look at the numbers of people in prison as a form of counterinsurgency before the insurgency. The authorities, looking at the history and how the resistance of black people sparked a broader revolutionary movement that knocked the whole system back on its heels, and moving to head that off this time by entrapping many of the youth of the oppressed in the criminal justice system and warehousing so many in prison. And it is very important that people take that up, because it is not the fault of the people in prison and their bad choices that put them in that situation. It's the society and the system that put them up against it, because people did not choose to strip the ghettos and barrios of legitimate ways to, you know, employment opportunities, to raise a family and survive, to wreck the educational systems in the way that James talked about so that they don't teach people to think critically. That was not the choice of the people. That was the dictates of the system, what its interests are. And right now, this mass incarceration is a very big attack on people that literally weighs down on the lives of millions and millions of people. And by taking this on and showing what's really going on around this, we can begin to strip away the legitimacy of this system and show what its operation is really based on. And people need to take this up. They need to look back to Attica and the importance of the uprising of the prisoners there, but also what the prisoners accomplished as they were rising up, the way in which they gave people a vision of a different way that society could be run, because that's something we can and must do today. And in fact, we're in better position to do it today, because the guy you're going to, you know, play the clip of me interviewing, Bob Avakian, has dug into the experience of previous revolutionary societies and got at what they did right, but also at the shortcomings and errors, so that we can go farther and do better the next time that power's in the hands of the people. So,
all right, we're going to have to cut it off.
We need to look at this. Let me just give a way that people could get in touch.
Sure, that's fine.
Stop Mass Incarceration at ymail.com. If you want to hear more about what we got planned in the middle of October, if you want to get involved in building some real resistance to this racially targeted mass incarceration, get in touch. Stop Mass Incarceration, one word, at ymail.com.
All right. Thank you very much, Carl. And James, the Dr. Benjamin, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Take care now. All right. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and James the Dr. Benjamin, a former prisoner in Attica State Prison, participant in the Attica Rebellion, and one of the moral compass points of that rebellion. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, I'll give a little introduction to the interview you're going to hear with Bob Avakian in the aftermath of 9/11. All right, welcome back. That's Conspiracy of Thought with Blowback. All right, now, leading up into this next segment, I just want people to think about a few points. Everybody today needs to ask themselves and each other, what kind of society has come into being since September 11th, 2001? Where is it headed, and is this the kind of world we want to live in? The horrors of 9/11 and the even more horrific 10 years since then should raise profound questions about the world we live in and the world we want to live in. It poses before people the road of fundamentally challenging the system, and I think fighting to bring a better world into being. And I want to actually, with that as an introduction, I want people to check out this excerpt from an interview that Carl Dix did with Bob Avakian back in 2002. And it was something that was really, I think, a very much needed political leadership and orientation in the wake of all that was going on in the country at this time and in the world. So check it out.
Okay, well, going along with some of the global moves they're making, there's also the heightened repression right here in this country. And again, there's a question of they've moved very quickly to implant a repressive clampdown post September 11th, but even some of the things that they've imposed were things that they had in the works. You know, when you look at the Patriot Act, there were things that they were trying to push through prior to September 11th, as well as some things that were more newly pushed forward in their program following September 11th. We're talking about the roundups of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants, the detention of, I guess, more than 1,000, and hundreds of them still remain in jail, you know, and they've been able to tie virtually nobody to anything that went down around September 11th. So how are people to understand that? How should we look at that?
Well, again, I think, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier, that September 11th was an event that they did have to respond to. In other words, assuming that they themselves weren't behind it, and they, as the statement of the Committee of the Revolutionary Internationalist Movement pointed out, and this is something I keep coming back to because I think it really captures something important, you know, in the murky world of intelligence, you know, where duplicity is the currency, it may be impossible to know exactly who was involved in this, who is Osama bin Laden, who, you know, historically was tied with the U.S., and now they say he's turned against the U.S., maybe that's so, but, you know, it's not clear what all the different arrangements are and what all the different links and ties are between, you know, different intelligence agencies, U.S., Israeli, or whatever. But let's assume that there was, you know, there was actually an attack that went down that killed, you know, thousands of civilians in the U.S., and that is something that whatever the U.S. knew about it in advance or whatever different forces, you know, linked up with U.S. institutions may or may not have known about it. The fact is they did have to respond to that. They can't, like, again, like, you know, mafia monsters on a, you know, on a worldwide scale. They can't let something like that go on, you know, and appear vulnerable. You know, they don't give a damn about the people who die there. The only thing they care about is, you know, they kind of have it seem that they can't maintain order in their own country. So they don't give a damn about the people that died, and they're doing monstrous things in the name of the people who died. But clearly, the main thing that's going on is that they had a program that they were already moving to implement on a certain level, and now they've seized on this situation that was created by September 11th to go, you know, pull out the throttle full scale and go try to ram this through. That's why, you know, in a big way, that's what we call it, a juggernaut. And this does include their whole, you know, open-ended war internationally, but it must also be accompanied by this kind of heightened repression you're talking about within the U.S., because you can't go and wage an open-ended war like this and not have a lot of repressive mechanisms already being implemented and much more machinery ready to bring into play if and when this kind of thing starts to get out of hand and there's a lot of resistance, you know, and there's what they call quote-unquote blowback, you know, internationally or even within the U.S. itself. You know, things could get very, you know, much out of hand by what they're unleashing and the very, you know, things that they're bringing into being. So they need both repression now, and they also need, you know, to prepare for even further heightening that repression as things go down the road. And, you know, it's very clear that, like, they're creating a sort of a openly declaring that sort of an open-ended war, and therefore creating a situation of a country that's more or less permanently at war. That's a permanent feature of the country now. And then what has to go along with that is a lot of police state repression and a whole repressive and intimidating atmosphere. You know, because you can't carry out the one without carrying out the other. These, you know, these things are of a piece for the reasons that I've said. You know, and so clearly a lot of this has to do with their imperial aims and ambitions that were at play. You know, things they were doing in the region around Afghanistan in terms of the oil and, you know, the pipelines for the oil. Again, this has been analyzed in our newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, and people should check that out. But it's clear that they're, you know, in terms of the contention between different, not only, you know, corporations, but imperialist states over control of that oil. Russia's in the picture, you know, Germany's in the background, you know. There's the question of other countries like Japan that are very dependent on foreign sources of oil in the Persian Gulf, and now these, you know, areas not in Afghanistan, but near Afghanistan, through which is, you know, where this pipeline would have to carry the oil. All this is part of what's been in motion well before September 11th. They were working with the Taliban for a while, you know, because they in connection with this. Then they figured that Taliban, you know, A, couldn't stabilize things as well as they needed them to, and B, were, you know, not as important to their whole scheme of things when they started working with some of these other regimes that were formerly part of the Soviet Empire, you know, in Central Asia. Now, you know, now they're working with a lot of the former, you know, revisionist, you know, phony communist party bosses who were, you know, now become openly bourgeois political leaders in a lot of these republics around the, you know, in the area around Afghanistan. So this is, you know, it's a shifting alliances that they're using. You know, like they just use, you know, when something or when someone or some force is useful to them, then they make use of them. And when things shift, they just toss them aside or trample on them. That's what they did also with Saddam Hussein, whom, you know, they helped arm and turn against Iran in the war, and then they, you know, kept that war going to weaken both sides. It's the kind of thing they do all the time, and they had a lot of this stuff in motion well before September 11th, and obviously then again they've seized on September 11th to clamp, you know, to push this full throttle and to clamp down, you know, on any of forces or sections of society they think might already be, you know, might already come forth in opposition, and to prepare the basis to clamp down much more forcefully and broadly on society as a whole, and to create a whole repressive and intimidating atmosphere where even to raise questions or dissent has been called, you know, traitorous, or, you know, giving aid and comfort to the terrorists. And this whole thing about you're either with us or you're with the terrorists is obviously meant to intimidate and stifle even questioning, let alone dissent and resistance.
Yeah, your discussion of the need on their part to clamp down on resistance now and be in position for even greater resistance that might break out as things go forward has brought up two things to me. One is, you know, just the experience of being in New York in the aftermath of September 11th, because one thing that developed, you know, immediately afterward was kind of a scene in an area in Manhattan called Union Square, which it's interesting, it's been a place where a lot of demonstrations step off from. Mm-hmm. And when this happened, it became the place that people came to debate and discuss what was happening around this situation. And you'd have people, you know, who were coming, questioning, like, why do people around the world hate us? What's going on here? What is it that the United States is doing? Should the United States respond? How should it? Some people were arguing, you know, that they were really shaken by what happened in New York on September 11th, but they didn't want to see a war in response to that. Other people were like, well, the U.S. has to respond. And it became an area of open debate and discussion where a significant edge of it was kind of capsulized in a slogan, and let me see if I can get this right, our grief is not a cry for war. Mm-hmm. It became something that people were like making signs, carrying around stickers, banners, you know, and really got taken up by a broad array of people as expressing how they felt about this. On the one hand, that they did have genuine grief for the friends, loved ones, neighbors, and even just fellow city dwellers who did die on that day, but also that that grief should not be used as a justification for the United States to rain death and destruction on the people of Afghanistan. And as they're promising and positioning themselves to carry out, spreading even farther around the world. So, I mean, that was one thing that I thought about in reference to that. The other thing is it brought to mind Lenin's point during World War I that he raised in opposition to the people who were, you know, chilled into inactivity by the strength of their government as it moved, as it initiated war, and the seeming public support for that, feeling that there was nothing that could be done at that point. And Lenin brought forward that never is a government more in need of the acquiescence of the masses than when they go to war. And that seems to me to be an important point that, you know, we need to understand and spread among people now in the situation that we're facing.
Yeah, well, I think it's important, you know, picking up on what you were saying. I think if you look at the way, you know, what their wild ambitions are, what their agenda is for sort of reshuffling the deck, recasting the whole world order in order to more firmly, you know, implant and fortify their domination and their top dog position and their global exploitation, you know, then clearly they need the, you know, not to have opposition to that. They need to have people silenced and obedient, you know, and cowed now, and even weakened in their ability to wage resistance as things go down the road. Because as you're talking about, again, it's clear this is not motivated by, you know, certainly not by bringing justice for what happened on September 11th, you know, whatever that means when, you know, when you're talking about imperialists. But also it's not largely in response to the events of September 11th themselves, although there's an element of that, as I spoke to earlier, in terms of the mafia logic that they employ on a worldwide and monstrous level. But they're, you know, you're talking about they got troops in the Philippines, they're talking about Somalia, or even, you know, more outstanding example, Nepal, which has nothing to do with September 11th, you know, but has to do with their enforcing and trying to fortify their imperialist domination everywhere. This is an open-ended, you know, a war they've declared. You know, I it's hard to think back in history and find another example of, a, at least on this level, of an open-ended declaration of war, basically wheeling around with their weapons, saying we can attack anybody, anywhere, anytime we want, you know, by any means. And they're even talking about, while they're, you know, talking, while there's, you know, warning about the danger of others having weapons of mass destruction, they're, you know, they're developing further their nuclear weapons, you know, they're breaking out of the ABM treaty, they're talking about restructuring their priorities as far to where to, as far as where to aim their nuclear weapons, you know, and they're making noises as they did even in the Gulf War, you know, 10 years ago, more or less. They openly talked then, and they're talking even more now about using nuclear weapons if it comes down to it, you know. So when you have something like that, you know, that's at play, you know, and it's, you know, when you have something like that that's, you know, your agenda, when that's what you're setting out to do, then you've got to, you know, clamp down, and you've got to prepare to clamp down even much more forcefully, and, you know, on an even broader basis, because that could give rise to all kinds of unexpected things and things that could get out of their control. And even though they're trying to do it in a controlled way, you know, in a, you know, step by step, at any step, and certainly through the course of the whole thing, all kinds of forces could get unleashed that would be wildly out of their control, and all kinds of things could get at play that would be hard for them to, you know, to keep hemmed in. So they need to have a whole atmosphere, and they do need, as you said, the support of the mass of people, or at least the quiet, you know, acquiescence of the people. You know, they need people not even to question, certainly not to criticize, you know, and not to oppose. They need people to be cowed at a minimum, you know, even if they can't get active support. And they do have active support, you know, partly on the basis of playing on September 11th and partly on the basis of appealing to people's privilege, you know, as part of living in an imperialist country where some of the spoils from this whole plunder worldwide are, you know, parceled out on, you know, on a certain scale to certain more privileged sections especially. They do have some basis where people are confused or even more, you know, actively supporting them, but they need much more than that. They need a cowed population, an intimidated population, because they know that there are broad sections of the population, despite what they claim with their polls and everything else, who are at a minimum questioning and, you know, have stirrings of unrest and unease about everything they're doing, and, you know, and who, if they're not already opposing it, could well come forward in opposition if this thing, you know, becomes more pronounced, and if what they're really about with this, you know, becomes more clearly out into the open and runs into some of the real, you know, contradictions and lets loose some of the forces that it could easily let loose.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he was being interviewed by Carl Dix, a founding member of that party. And that interview happened back in 2002, and it was a time when really it provided very important political leadership and some means to actually sit down and figure out what the hell was going on in the world and what we need to do about it. The responsibility of the people to stand up and to work to change the world. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela and Bianca Bagatorian, and we'll be talking about the global stage, the theater movement in a post 9/11 world. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war.
All right, Germany, just before the war. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. And that was an extremely appropriate song for our next conversation. We're going to be talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela, Artistic Director of the Latino Theater Company and the Los Angeles Theater Center, and Bianca Bagatorian, who's a playwright and president of the Armenian Dramatic Arts Alliance. And we're talking about how 9/11, September 11th, and what was unleashed on the world, what impact that had on theater and art in general. And just some broad statements from either, from both of you at the time. Bianca, what do you think was the impact of that?
Well, I think it really brought to light the gap of understanding that really exists between us and the Middle East. Having been born in Iran and growing up in Iran, I kind of understand that it's very difficult for us to understand the culture really deeply. And the way things are presented in this country, when I hear things on the news, like when they talk about Iran's nuclear program, you know, they lose me. I think to myself, what nuclear program? There are countries that are, you know, have so much more advanced nuclear programs than Iran. And suddenly, you know, they're using this sort of jargon myth building to terrorize people, to scare people. And this widens the gap, which to me is, as an artist, what I try and do the opposite. I try and bridge that gap a little more so that people can really understand what's going on. Because this myth building really, I think it serves these evildoers and it serves them to their purposes and their ends, which aren't necessarily what's good for the people.
Jose Luis, what about you?
Well, I think, as you know, what happened after 9/11, this patriotism that came out in the United States, and what we began to analyze, I mean, it was a great opportunity for the United States to really do self-analysis and understand what the world was like, you know, how they saw us, what perception they had, you know, from where we are. And I think we didn't take an opportunity for that as a country. But the most committed artists, I think, began that process of trying to see what is the perception that the world has, you know, of the United States, of us, of the artists. And we're beginning to find out, you know, they don't know much about us anymore. Have to understand in the 70s and the 80s, we used to travel all over the world. We used to have touring companies all over the world talking about what the artists in this country were doing, you know, the most progressive people or the most avant-garde part of the country. And that ended during the Reagan administration. So now what the other world, any part of the world, knows about the type of art that we do, they don't have any understanding. And it's been very revelatory. And I think in our side, what we're trying to do is, you know, okay, let's begin a dialogue. Let's bring the people from, you know, other parts of the world into the country so we can begin a dialogue of understanding and see, you know, who you are. I mean, it's really a dialogue. It's been a you know, I always say the arts in this country have had a crisis since the Reagan administration. I mean, we've been in a vacuum for the last 30 years. It's amazing.
We're talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela, the Artistic Director of the Latino Theater Company and the Los Angeles Theater Center, and Bianca Bagatorian, playwright and director of the Armenian Dramatic Arts Alliance. But part of this, I think, actually, if you think about 9/11, we were just talking about this a little earlier. If you think about 9/11, right in the immediate aftermath, there was this wave of grotesque chauvinism,
yes,
and patriotism that was, they hate us, they hate our freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, they had, I mean, all of this stuff that was, you know, put out, and the denigration of the people in the Middle East and people and other people all over the world. Anybody who wasn't 100% American would get, you know, trashed, basically. And then it was all leading up to, and there was a whole culture developed around projecting that American arrogant, chauvinistic, imperialist, you know,
that's right,
terror around the world. And I, you know, one of the things that actually struck me is it was very difficult, I think, at that time. There was, frankly, a lot of artists in the immediate aftermath didn't really step forward. There was a struggle over you got to walk into the jaws of the wolf, you know, when you're doing that. And I think there's actually, you know, there's still a struggle that goes on today. And there's a number of questions that get debated out, I think, both in terms of the responsibility of the artist, but also, you know, there's a need for a moral compass point in the midst of this thing, you know, to actually get out there. And what role do you think the arts and the artists have in that? And how do you think people have been doing?
Yeah, there was a lot of fear. I think, you know, people took a step back and just tried to reassess and sort of digest what was going on. And it really sort of put us more on a global stage rather than just living in America and thinking about what goes on in America. But really now, what does the world think? And to reassess our values and our morals, I think it really changed the way artists started to approach their work as well.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of fear, too, because you didn't want to see Anne Petrarek at the time, and you were judged immediately. You were talking one of the issues that we had in the country, whatever it was, then you have to be very careful how you treat it as an artist. I mean, I think I did a play about Iraq. I think you saw Melancholia.
Yeah.
You know, this was like 2003. And we were talking about already, you know, the soldiers coming back. And it was really interesting that you know, people didn't know how to take it, even though I thought it was a very important work. They didn't know how to take it. And trying to, when we had the scene from the Iraqi woman coming to picking up the bodies on stage, I remember people not knowing how to react to that, you know, and thinking, wow, how little do we know? But I think, meaning more and more, and I don't know, you know, I'm so skeptical about, you know, how do we understand the artists in this country, what our responsibility is as citizens of the world, you know, how deep the analysis have to be in order to put our thoughts forward, how we want a bigger dialogue, you know, in the world, you know, it's what art is supposed to be. That's our responsibility. We're supposed to question.
Well, let's explore this a little bit, you know, this point about, and I do think this was one of the critical questions that people had to grapple with in coming up out of that situation in the aftermath of 9/11, and it's continued through to now. I mean, look, we have, what, four or five wars going on, you know, and yeah. there's not, neither culturally nor broadly in society, there is not the commensurate response that's needed, you know. This is just horrific that these kinds of things that can be going on steady on. And you know, I saw the My Name is Rachel Corey out of Theatrical mm-hmm. and Botanical mm-hmm. Movement. Very, very compelling, powerful play. Mm. But I'll tell you what, you know, that should be playing to large audiences, large mm-hmm. theaters, whatever, but it's not, you know.
It's interesting that it's not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that in terms of this sharper edge around morality, do you think that that's actually developed? And you know, because there's the view that the people of the world are not our enemy, and that's actually needs to develop as a more powerful counterpoint to the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's happening, or what do you think the obstacles are?
Well, I worked with the historian, the late historian Howard Zinn, the year before he passed away, and I was doing a play with him about his work. And, you know, I asked him as a historian what was the most important thing, what was the essence of his work. And he said, you must know your history. So when your president stands up there and says, let's go to war, you can look back and say, oh, they said that before. And that what the president says is not necessarily for the good of the country. And if you know your history, you'll be able to judge that. And so the piece we worked on and I'm writing about him is how most of the wars in this country, I can say almost all of the wars, were based on lies. Mm. And I think that's quite enlightening. And maybe through work like that, just to get people to analyze what's happened in the past, we can sort of make better decisions in going towards the future.
Mm-hmm. Jose Luis?
Well, I think we somehow, I mean, have to create a larger dialogue in the country about everything that's going on, about the war and the lack of information that we have and the lack of analysis that people is doing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the media doesn't help at all, you know.
No. Except for some, of course.
Present company accepted, you know, yes.
It's really difficult, you know, because the only thing we get is really bad propaganda and
entertainment like, in the news.
Yeah, you know, and so how, I mean, it becomes, we do political plays.
Yeah,
you know,
we turn entertainment into news because we're not getting it where we should be getting
LATC,
it.
I mean, you saw the Devil's Advocate, you saw, you know, we do, I think, word that matters is the way I call it, you know, which is important for the community to have this dialogue. But it is a struggle, yeah. And I think we have to continue and do it more and do it with a lot more strength and have a bigger relationship between those of us who feel that as artists we have a responsibility to society, to the world.
I think your festival is great. You have performers from the Ukraine, Germany, Canada, Japan, Iran, Guatemala, and Armenia, of course. And I thank you for bringing over the dance group from Armenia.
Yeah.
I think this kind of thing is really good. You know, it promotes understanding through the culture.
I think so. I think it's a beginning of something that, you know, we should have a lot more of it.
Yes. And, of course, there's in promoting this understanding, there's finding the right language to have these conversations with. You know, this broken language for a broken world, you know, it's very difficult to find ways of communicating to people through that, too.
And I want to thank you both for joining us today. And, unfortunately, we run up on the clock. But, you know, we need to have the two of you back and have this discussion maybe for a half an hour sometime soon.
Yeah,
would you
feel
for doing that? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela and Bianca Bagatorian about the role of the artist in the post-9/11 world. All right. Before we leave this week, I have some very important news. Troy Davis, you know, those of you who were listening last week or maybe who know about the case in general, know about the case of Troy Davis, an innocent black man who was convicted of murdering a cop. And despite many, many, many of the eyewitnesses recanting their testimony, all of the evidence, there actually being no physical evidence at all that Troy Davis was guilty of anything, and in fact, everything pointing to his innocence, Georgia has set an execution date for him, September 21st to 28th. Anytime between September 21st and September 28th, he may be executed. Only the Georgia Clemency Board can stop that right now, and they don't have a good record on that one. They already refused him once. So you should make your opinion heard around this. Go to TroyAnthonyDavis.org, check out what you can do, and please stand up, demand that this execution be stopped. I want to thank all of my guests for today. I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And most of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And remember, we don't have to live this way. There's absolutely no reason that we do live this way except for the system that forces us to live like this. What we need more than anything else is revolution. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song from Archie Shepp that was written in the aftermath of the Attica Rebellion. It was inspired by the Attica Rebellion, and it's one that's inspired many, many other people all throughout those decades since the Attica Rebellion. And the song is Attica Blues. Talk to you again next week.